Baby Pictures of Famous Dictators Podcast, Episode 6. I'm Managing Editor Karin Patachin, and with me today is J.W. McCormick, David Bowie historian and expert. J.W., thanks for being here.
Hi, Carmen. Thanks a lot. Pleasure.
We're here today to talk about David Bowie's new album, The Next Day. His first album in 10 years. Since what?
Reality.
Since Reality. Preceded by Heathen.
Right.
Loose trilogy in a way.
Well, we can talk about that.
Yeah, we're going to get to that later.
And we'd be looking at the tracks, talking about the music, and I'm afraid in that capacity I might disappoint you, because it's my feeling that nothing could be more absurd. Actually, nothing could matter less than talking about the music, at least first. If we want to work our way there, that's one thing. But the music itself is definitely the least important thing to think about in figuring out what's going on here with The Next Day.
So you're saying track-by-track analysis is sort of a moot point.
Any kind of analysis is really a moot point. When you listen to this album, it is the kind of thing about which anything can be said. And so it's a good thing that I'm here, because about things that anything can be said...
You're the authority.
It's important to say the right thing. And as far as I know, I'm the only person with the credentials.
Wholeheartedly agree.
So the thing is, maybe the first thing to do is just to rehearse the bare facts as far as we know them. The album comes after a 10-year hiatus and was released without any fanfare.
No preamble.
That's right. On Bowie's birthday, I think January 8th or 9th.
66 years old.
Yeah, 66th birthday, exactly. Or rather, that was the announcement. It was
right.
Released with a video and the accompanying song. Another song and video followed shortly thereafter, and he just dropped the album. Recorded in secret over a 2-year period, right?
Yes, yeah. Downtown Manhattan.
Yeah.
But apparently the total amount of time that they've spent was only 3 months in the studio, and it was a sort of scattershot
recording
process.
Right.
Which I don't know if you feel that translates to the album. It feels like there's different modes going on.
Well, certainly. The thing is... whole people have come into there, and at no other point have a whole audience, new Bowie audience, has formed during this time.
Correct.
10 years is a long time, so plenty of people have come totally into their knowledge of Bowie in this period without any new album. So this is the first new Bowie album for a generation.
Yeah.
And Bowie himself seems to be perfectly aware of that. Hence the cover, which is nothing more than the cover of Heroes, defaced,
yes.
Basically, with The Next Day printed over it, and the title of the album written out in the new title, just scratched out as though with a Sharpie.
Mm-hmm.
So this has never been true before. There's a couple of cliches I just want to nip in the bud here. When people say, how's the new album, a Bowie album, the traditional answer is it's the best one since Scary Monsters.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody always says that.
As in reference to this album or in reference to previous
Any
albums
album.
As well?
It's a meaningless statement.
Okay.
It's utterly meaningless statement.
So you're saying for most people there's a chronological stoppage in Bowie that ends with Scary Monsters and everything else is after, a sort of AD,
not
BC
exact-
thing?
Well, not exactly. Well, certainly like the 10 years loosely beginning with The Man Who Sold the World and leading up to Scary Monsters is, of course, one of the things that's best in life.
Yes.
One of the most sublime, like, aesthetic experiences. Those that are numb to it are the spiritually dead. It's one of the reasons to keep living that whole stretch beyond compare. And he does everything right. Is always at the crest of every movement, including movements that have yet to form or yet to exist. But then after that, in the 80s, he also does everything right in that he sells out and makes music that everybody hears but nobody thinks about, everybody listens to but nobody cares about. Makes dance music.
Yes.
Basically. And then in the 90s, I'm a big apologist for the 90s period, because his public had changed by the time that he was recording the 90s. I mean, the 90s, check it out. He's got he does a Britpop album with hip-hop elements, records an electronica soundtrack, The Boot of Suburbia, one of the more underrated Bowie albums. He has an industrial album with One Outside, recorded with Brian Eno. and a techno, and I mean techno, not electronic, but I mean like Pro Tools, drum and bass, like full-on thing in Earthling. And I think the feeling at the time was, why does Bowie have to do this? You know, why does he feel like he has to be cool? And it was like, well, of course he doesn't. This is always what he's done. You know, Bowie's always kind of, you know, we're not talking about an expressive artist here, you know, thank God. Think how bad most expressive art is. yeah, instead it's reactive, you know, yeah. that's always been the beauty of it. And then there were the albums in the zeros.
Well, before we move on to that, let's go back to the 90s for a sec. So you're saying that Bowie has always been a constant, a sort of mutable,
yeah, absolutely,
artist. But in the 90s, the culture changed around him, and the quality, do you feel, was in the same, or it was a lesser quality?
No, I don't think that at all.
Oh, you see.
I think the music that he was responding to was of less of a quality. I think the music was a lot worse in the 90s. I think that
it was a different vanguard he was at the front of. Kind of.
I think, well, let's think about it this way: the way the media was consumed had changed, just as the way media has consumed now has changed.
Correct.
After these 10 years, the way that we digest media is so different that we don't really listen to Bowie albums. We listen to like our favorites. We listen to to playlists. We listen to a collection.
Correct.
And so Bowie seems to recognize the freedom that allows him and capitalizes it on this album. So what he's responding to this time doesn't appear to be soul music like Young Americans, recorded with like Luther Vandross.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, which by the way, people getting at him for making like industrial or techno music, you let the guy, record like a Black album in the mid, in Philadelphia, and like the, white boy British guy in the midst, you're not going to let him get away with like, a Trent Reznor album in 1993, give me a break. No, it's no worse than most of the music of the period. In fact, some of this stuff is really, really exemplary and completely of its time. What I was going to say before is, it seems like what he's responding to now is really Bowie. He's conscious of having a sound built piecemeal out of all of the sounds that he's made so far, and he seems to be very aware of the new fan base that's come to him has this kind of freedom and flux, and he feels free to reference everything that he's done so far, and so it's an impossible album to hear. That's why I say it's fruitless to try to talk about the tracks in depth, although I'm excited to try, because it's a truly solipsistic experience. You can only really hear yourself hearing Bowie. Everybody kind of seems to feel like they have a stake in it. You know, everyone's just going to hear their favorite aspects of Bowie or pick up on things. And it's true. This album is just laced with references to older works. It's just full of Easter eggs for the Bowie fans, and it's really kind of playful in its way. And so, I guess creepy too, because it comes. It's possible that the best career move he ever did was this 10 years of silence. That's an unheard
album. Almost starving the public for.
Yeah, well, and it's an unheard album. It's kind of an album that we all imagined,
which no longer exists in this climate. Like an unheard album that sort of dropped.
Well, now we've heard it.
Yeah.
Well, now we've heard it. So now the unheard album that we all imagined, the absence is like speaking to us. And you remember during this period, there are a lot of creepy rumors. You know, Bowie is sick or Bowie's left
Flaming
music.
Lips and song. Is Bowie dying?
Right, right. Yeah, that creeped us all out, you know? So this album kind of drops beyond the veil, as it were,
right,
with like total like anonymity and like silence. No tour, no big announcement.
Even the videos, the Where Are We Now video, it's almost like he doesn't appear until almost
80%
into the video.
It's a posthumous work. And so we've always thought about, you know, Bowie as writer, you know, Bowie as the,
right.
Bowie as the writer, you know, in that it was like, you know, well, yeah, but like, I'm nobody and look at me and I'm everybody, but also did you know that I'm the secret heart of everything?
Correct.
You know? And so with this album, it's like the, it's like the kind of adjacency that Blanchot talks about. You know, he seems to have been dropped from beyond the wall of death that we're all kind of writing toward. It's a warning that death is loose in the world.
Right. Are you surprised that David Bowie didn't fake his death and then release this album as a posthumous album?
I'm not sure that he has to fake his death. I think that the silence speaks volumes for somebody as like irascible as and
prolific.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, literally, like an album every 2-3 years, you know, his whole life. And this
76, he put out 2 albums in like, I mean, 8 months, right?
There's never been time for a new fan base to germinate like this before. You know,
right.
You've been able to, people have been able to come up and listen to every single Bowie album with total absence of Bowie, without the new album or the new tour to muddle it. Any other artist you can think of, if you want to see them in concert, you'd go and you'd watch them play their new songs. You'd be like, oh, get to the hits.
Right.
You know, Bowie hasn't done a thing like that. He's just been a wall. Yeah, right.
You know, I think the cover is important to look at. I think absence is smart to bring up because it's literally an absence within his former work.
Right. And speaking of walls, he's looking at he's looking to the Berlin period, or is he? Maybe he's not. It seems like he knows that anything he says we're going to interpret, and so he says as little as possible, as leading as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
which is in its own way a type of leading.
I think he's used to the way that he's spoken of at this point. I think he's very aware of that he has to do very little. In order to get everyone talking. It's a really savvy move. Yeah, and super interesting.
While we're on that sort of point, so you view this as a continuation of this sort of the Knot trilogy?
Yeah, in some important
sense. More than a continuation of the Berlin trilogy with the same
producer. In the following way. It sounds like Bowie's listening to Bowie for the first time in his life. It doesn't sound like Bowie was ever a guy that listened to his own music quite a lot.
Right.
And in that, he was never... There really wasn't a next day. He never seemed to become a whole person. He never seemed to, like, go to the natural level or
he never sort of went into self-commodification that a lot of...
Yeah, exactly right.
Did.
He never became Dylan after the crash, you
right.
know? Yeah, he was always just kind of thirsty to channel everything else back. And that is not to say that there's anything kind of, you know, stultified about these three albums. But, like, people call them neoclassicist albums. Now, that, again, is just meaningless talk. It doesn't really mean anything at all. You know, he was... it was easy to see... People said... oh, these are his most personal albums. Here he seems to manifest a personality we haven't seen before. And again, that's absolutely meaningless. You know, he's not that kind of artist.
No.
It's not that he's speaking from his heart, exactly, or anything like that. You can perish the whole sticky notion. It's a terrible thought.
Yeah, I don't think Bowie's ever been an artist of encrypted autobiography anything like that.
Oh, it's a terrible idea. You know, that's the whole appeal.
And it's his divergence from that makes him who he is.
Oh, yeah, or makes us who we are. We can see anything there.
Right.
You know? And I think he sees what we see in him, and he sees it there too.
Yes,
that's not
and
the
he
same.
Anticipates it.
That's not the same as honesty or earnesty or anything ugly like that.
No. So let's we talked about the album a little bit, but we're gonna talk about it live because Bowie, although it's now a sort of another absence that he won't be performing these songs live, supposedly.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how these songs would maybe theoretically fit into a live setup. His pre-existing set list such. So I think the question I have it worded is, though he's abandoned playing live, what songs up the next day do you think would best lend themselves to the pre-existing set list that he has?
Pre-existing as of the last time he toured in 2004, I guess? Yeah, Staples. Are there staple tracks on here? Yeah, I guess that's a tricky one because it is such a an enigmatic end note album, you know?
Yeah.
In a playful another way, it doesn't have like a perfect interface with. I mean, you know, it's every single song seems to have within it so many references to other, you know, to the rest of the catalog, with a few exceptions. I think I'd Rather Be High would be nice. That seems to harken back almost to Hunky Dory days and Quicksand and stuff like that. And the opener is great, of course. It's got like transgendered priests, and it sounds to me kind of like Thus Spoke Zarathustra, but supposedly he's looking into Christian myth there. Yeah, but it's a rocker. Yeah, part of what was
the heaviness of this album is it's surprising.
Yeah, that's great, man. That's great.
Awesome.
Yeah, if you just heard the lead in,
especially You Set the World on Fire, like.
It is really rocking.
Yeah.
It really, really moves. I think
for someone
that,
who was supposedly dying.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really feel any. I mean, it was great to hear Where Are We Now, but I didn't care about the song very much. Not at first. By the way, I think that these songs sound a lot. They gain a lot more without the videos. I like them better in context. The two singles, that is.
Yeah.
But yeah, kind of weak lead-ins, you know, or at least they didn't seem to indicate what the album was really going to be. Literally every other track is completely different from Where Are We Now.
Yeah, that's totally true. It's a sort of anomaly on the album. And
yeah.
I think
So you clearly have thoughts about this. What are the ones you want to hear in the set list?
You Will Set the World on Fire, I think, is great. I think it would fit, or we actually had another frame. They were going to say, like, what previous Bowie album would you insert them into? Sort of what iteration of his touring groups?
Well, he seems to anticipate that we're going to be thinking about this.
Of course.
We mentioned before we started recording that, of course, everybody is talking about how the drumbeat of 5 years is eerily inserted into
the outro of You Will Feel So Lonely, You Will Die.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that would be great on stage.
Yeah, I'm not sure what would happen to these songs without the production. Because the production is a weird aspect as well. Because clearly, like, it's a real tight production. The songs are kind of short, and they kind of get in and get out for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, there's very few that really, like, linger. None overstay their welcome. Everyone seems to know pretty much what they're doing. I think if anyone that suspected that this was going to be a deal where they were just going to, like, dick around in the studio and, like, you know, write songs on the fly, Bowie clearly went in there knowing exactly what he was going to do and came out again.
Right.
And, you know, I think that has kind of a dark side as well. Because they sound so clean, you know, they sound awfully clean.
They're very clean.
They don't sound contemporary, you know. So for that reason, they don't really sound contemporary. I mean, it's Bowie has never sounded this unfashionable in the sense that the style now is for that washed out sound and the grist and the, like, you know, the really shrieky, glassy
lush
production.
Overproduction.
Yeah, exactly. Lush overproduction is hot, and this is clean, you know, and the real clean. The drumming is kind of weird. I don't like the drumming so much. Drumming, I guess, has never been Bowie's strong suit.
I was going to say, but then the thing about Bowie is there is sort of a tinny or a light feel to the percussion. Then when you see him live, it's a completely different experience. I feel as though he might compensate live.
Hmm.
When I saw the two times.
How uncomfortable with the idea of seeing Bowie live. How can you...
In concert, his percussion section
is
much
know.
Different than on the albums.
I'm not obsessed with embodiment. I like the live albums, of course, but those are just more albums as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Yeah, Santa Monica, of course, being peak.
And we have to also remember that these songs would probably be considerably different live, that he puts them through many iterations. I think on Bowie at the Beep, he does Ziggy Stardust 3 times in one set.
Oh, man. Right.
It's just intense stuff. So, do you feel as though this album has recharacterized Bowie's... Like, is it an end note thing that has now cast everything else in a different light? Is it not that? Is it more isolated within his greater work?
Oh, it's in the Eye of the Beholder. And it's almost like a joke about that. It almost seems to...
A joke from Bowie or a joke?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. It seems like almost ironical about that. It's always been that... we see what we want to see in Bowie for the most part. He kind of reflects back the era, and now he's reflecting the Bowie era. Now he's reflecting everything that we recognize. It's kind of a tour back, much like the kind in a similar but different way that the last two albums, Heathen and Reality, were as well. Although there was a weird aspect on those albums where there were two covers per album, so. On Heathen, he does an old Neil Young song, and he does Cactus by the Pixies. Strange choice. And then in Reality, he does Pablo Picasso by the Modern Lovers and a George Harrison song. So he does, like, one, like, you know, square song and one, like, real hip song. And that was kind of would tell you that those were the two poles through which those albums oscillated. Now, here it's a little different because he doesn't have any covers exactly. But the last track is an extremely... forbidding,
homage.
Yeah, kind of a forbidding, kind of wailing, and his vocal style is taken, I won't say copied, but appropriated straight from Scott Walker, who's been an important figure in the Bowie canon for a long time. I mean, you could be fooled into thinking it's a Scott Walker song.
Right. Maybe just expand on Scott Walker for a sec for any people that don't know who he is.
Right, so Scott Walker...
Like myself, 5 minutes ago.
Right, so Scott Walker was a member of the Walker Brothers. I think he was the lone American in this British group in the 60s who would have been kind of also-rans beside, like, the Who and the Stones and the Beatles. At some point, Scott Walker, more kind of fundamentally interesting and than the other, with a weird Kurt Weill vocal style, left all that and kind of became this this eccentric recluse who made albums who, let's say, the his singing style didn't lend themselves to instrumentation. And then they continued to get stranger and stranger. Bowie covered a Walker Brothers song, Night Flights, in his early 90s album, I think 1991 album, Black Tie, White Noise. But Scott Walker kept making albums. He was another guy who would leave long absences between albums. His most recent one is Bish Bosh, and it has, I kid you not, like orchestral farting. I think it has people punching meat. It's a real unpleasant listen, and it's avant-garde, but not in any particular avant-garde tradition. It's like a rock and roll guy deciding to do exactly the opposite of what makes sense.
Turning it inside out type.
Yeah, exactly. And Bowie seems to appreciate that. And so that's what that last track is. That's what that last track is doing there. The one that starts with Mishima's dog and my father ran the prison and all that is
so that's one of the covers. And you said you have a theory about what the other one is.
Well, I don't know.
It's a little subtler than that.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm just aware that if there's one song that doesn't sound like much in the Bowie canon, it's the Dirty Boys, the second one.
Right.
You know, I'm sure people will point to Dum Dum Boys from the Iggy Pop side of the Berlin series. I think that's off. Is that the Idiot or Lust for Life, Dum Dum Boys? Well, anyway, but it's really unusual. And people have said Tom Waits, but personally, I hear Morphine, the band whose lead singer died on stage in 2000. So again,
what's that story?
Oh yeah, Mark Sandman. Well, I don't know. He had a heart attack and died on stage at the peak of his band's success. And Morphine went. I mean, the album, The Night. Which the songs of which sound awfully similar to the Dirty Boys, went on to become a real popular college album. Yeah. And so again, we have like it bookended by death. He seems to be again. We have the album is bookended by death and reclusion. So there's the death on stage of Mark Sandman, and then there's the almost weird like. Suicide-like silence of Scott Walker referenced on the last track. So this album kind of oscillates between like total removal and absence, while like kind of playfully flirting with the idea of the posthumous and how we bend everything an artist does to our own ideas about that artist. And for the first time, Bowie seems willing to like let that happen. But ultimately, the joke will be on us because listen to what idiots we sound even trying to talk about these songs.
Right. Do you feel that Bowie is sort of a middleman maybe between the greater population and these more obscure artists like Morphine and Scott Walker? That he's like...
I just think he listens well.
He's absorbing that and then turning it into his own thing, or
maybe at the end of the day, the Bowie's best trait above any musicality,
is as a listener.
Yeah, he's a good listener.
Yeah,
he seems to be a really good listener. He seems to know what he's listening to. We were talking about also. So there's a few other clues on this album that I don't want to lose sight of. We were talking a little bit about the fantasy of Bowie as writer and. I almost can't think of another album I've heard that's so name-droppy. All over this album are these weird lead-ins and clues and names, some of them very obscure, just kind of dropped in the lyrical content, and you can miss them if you're not paying attention. I think it's... one of them starts with, by mentioning Nabokov. You catch that?
I did not.
Nabokov is sunlicked in the beach at Grunewald. Yeah, I think that's I'd Rather Be High.
Okay.
I think the beginning of I'd Rather Be High mentions Nabokov.
Keep talking, I'll look up the lyrics here.
Right. So of course, Nabokov is the cosmopolitan writer who can learn a language and excel in it, and that seems like a good reference point. But then the next lyric gets even stranger because the beach at Grunewald is a beach in Germany, so it seems to stick with the theme of Bowie inviting us to compare the album to his Berlin series, but there's a homophone between Grunewald and Grunewald the artist Matthias Grunewald the artist who inspired a host of writers, including one that I really want to think about in terms of Bowie, and that's Sebald. Have you read Sebald?
W.G. Sebald.
Yeah, exactly.
I have not.
Yeah, so...
Quick to point out, though, these are just two lines in one of the songs.
That's right.
Why attempting to interpret the entire album is not intelligent.
What'd you say?
It's like a fool's errand. There's so much packed within each line. A lot of people, I mean, these record people that are writing 500-word reviews of this album.
Well, maybe. Except that I did a little detective work. And some of the other names that he mentions. So both Nabokov and Grunewald, the artist, Matthias Grunewald, show up in Sebald, as does a Belgian writer by the name of George Rosenbach, who shows up in one of these songs. He's almost untranslated into English. It's a real bizarre thing to
draw. Bowie doesn't speak German, or he does?
Oh, of course, I'm sure he does. Okay. But it's still, nonetheless, it's strange to drop into a rock song, this obscure Belgian. But the one thing that I could think of was that he's got a very famous tomb. His is one of the most famous tombs in Père Lachaise. It's a man emerging from burial, from a tomb, clutching a rose. He's got like his long, thin arm is stretching out, clutching a rose. And I think that's the imagery Bowie wants us to think of with this album. A guy emerging from underground and clasping the right. rose. Yeah. I also think
it's buried in there.
Yeah.
It's buried.
Yeah, I've done a lot of work on this.
I could tell. Very intense, though. But I mean, perfect image.
Yeah.
A lot of work to get there.
I still think he's thinking about Sebald, though, because you know Sebald, of course, is the German writer who we picture on a train walking into a town, buying a postcard or taking a picture, and realizing that from this little bit he knows everything about it. All history is contained within this single image, and I think that's the flaneur, the dilettante Bowie coming out. As he kind of, on this album, as he kind of goes from period to period and moves from style to style with every song.
So do you think the tomb would maybe be that image?
Yeah.
His Sebald image?
Yeah. I think that's his Sebald. Another one might be the question of Mishima's dog. That's another suicide point. Mishima's dog is referenced in the last track. I don't know if Mishima had a dog, so I don't know what that's about.
But
Mishima, of course, committed ritual suicide in 1970.
Yeah, so death is packed all through this.
Yeah, totally.
Not explicitly, though.
Well,
Mishima's dog is a little.
Well, you and I are probably a little different. But I for me, it's plain as day.
Yeah.
You know, I've been at this a while.
I can tell. Where are we moving on to now?
Oh, you want to ask me about my favorite piece of Bowie trivia?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Well, I've got a few. But there's one I like when, before they go to Berlin together, Bowie goes to visit Iggy Pop in, like, whatever, like, terrible, like, L.A., like, rehab sanitarium place. They've got they've got Iggy Pop, like, detoxing. Well,
Bowie's gone on record saying that city should be burned to the ground, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And
I don't know if this experience contributed to that.
I think it should be drowned, actually.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be an eventuality, right?
Yeah.
The waters will rise.
Iggy says, boy, I don't understand it. You do all the same things I do. Why do I always get in trouble? You always walk away looking clean. You're going to die, man. You're worse than I am, you know? And Bowie says, James, Jimmy, before I do anything, I ask myself, am I going to get away with it? And it just seems like the best advice you could ever give. Yeah.
Let's see, one of mine?
Sure.
Definitely, I was unawares. I was watching David Lynch's Fire Walk With Me.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's a great walk-on.
This is sort of a...
How did that happen?
I mean, this album's kind of a walk-on.
Yeah,
in the same
we're not going to talk about Judy, Carmen. We're not going to talk about Judy. I made it very clear I wasn't going to talk about Judy.
Disappears into the air. So for anyone who doesn't know... Bowie plays Philip Jeffries. I believe he's the Kyle MacLachlan character's ex-partner that's referenced throughout the show.
He's not an ex-partner exactly. He's like a...
Overseer?
He's an ex-agent. We don't know anything about him except that scene. I don't know. God knows. Like, it's like, did they meet at a party or something and decide they were both cool? And he's like, you want to be in my movie? Of course I do. You want me to be in your movie? Of course you do. I'm Bowie.
That sounds right. But I mean, all the indications that come with putting Bowie in that movie.
Yeah, so Bowie like walks like... out of an elevator into that movie, launches the movie into the coolest part, and then vanishes and is never spoken of
literally
again.
Yeah. So that's one of my favorites.
That's great.
Sort of came
that's
out
great.
Of left field. My other favorite one is that the electronic musician Moby. Are you familiar?
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, that's we're getting back to the 90s stuff, right?
Oh, no. This is beforehand.
Oh, yeah?
That Moby pursued his first job as a golf course caddy.
I didn't know that.
To purchase Lodger.
Oh, good.
And then upon... earning the money to buy Lodger, quit.
Yeah.
Which
goal reached.
Just...
Yeah.
which is just having your priorities completely in order.
Yeah, it takes a lot of
great
balls.
Great for Moby. I also love his interior design aesthetic.
Yeah.
He's great on Cribs.
Yeah.
Just like an empty attic sort of garret thing with only a harmonium in the middle.
That's Moby?
That's Moby, yeah.
What a
jerk. So did you have any more you wanted to touch on before we move on?
Let's move on.
All right, so let's get a little personal now.
Sure.
So talk about at what point in your life did you discover Bowie, and when did you know it was true love?
I don't think that there's any me before Bowie. there's nothing.
It's a chicken and the egg deal.
Yeah, there's nothing prior to me before Bowie. I was nothing. There's no way to even quantify that. It's frightening to even think about. But yeah, no, I do recall having a tape that my dad had made for me that had all the very best Bowie, mostly from the glam period. But I think there were a few radio mainstays like Blue Jean on there. Wow, that really, it really got me through like my early teenage years. I remember being at like the Tennessee State Fair, and I think it was this is great actually, because you know who was performing at the Tennessee State Fair that year was David Jones. Yeah, Davy Jones.
Davy Jones.
formerly of the Monkees.
Okay.
The impetus for young David Jones to change his name to
Bowie.
Yeah,
I was going
to
say same name.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember just being miserable. I'm looking at these like enormous pigs and cows they've got there and everything. And then when I listen to the tape, and then I'm walking around and listening to this tape, and suddenly everything is transfigured, and the light on the tilt-a-whirl, everything is just filled with light and beauty, and I realize that there's like another world inside of this one, and I immediately see like everything reflected. All of literature suddenly seems looming close to me. Everything seems to touch me.
Everything takes on brighter hues.
Oh,
type
yeah.
deal.
Before that, I think I probably just listened to like the presence of the United States of America or whatever.
Right.
You know, it was
peaches.
It was the '90s. It was rough, man. You know, we didn't know.
We didn't know. We should have listened. Mine was sort of. My dad was always a Bowie fan.
Yeah.
And my first memory, because he would always, we would play the albums in the car, and we had the external tape deck you could take out with the CD, the one CD in it. It would be extremely loud, but he wouldn't let you out of the car until the song was finished.
Yeah.
So he would like hold the seatbelt, the thumb over the seatbelt, letting you out.
Yeah.
The reverence there. I think it might be genetic. Your dad was big into Bowie?
Yeah, no, my dad was big into Bowie.
See, my dad was like lightning bolt over the face going to the concert.
Right. My dad was certainly had a good Bowie. I mean, my dad has a great music, an amazing music collection for sure. So I was, it was really, really rough as a kid too, because I would get into something cool, and my dad would have the whole thing. So I couldn't rebel.
You're beaten to it.
Yeah, I was always beaten to it. And my dad, to his credit, like kept abreast of everything for a real long time. I think like he himself draws the line at like Radiohead and. Beck. He was like, that was the last time that this was the kind of thing I would have been into that I was no longer into, you know, but up till that he really had it. So he had a huge Bowie collection, but I think more than that, he knew that I'd be into it. He recognized pretty soon that, you know, this was going to be the thing for me. And indeed, like even at a distance, like I even seeing the albums, you know, already there was some kind of glow there. So no, there's no prior Bowie. There's nothing there. It's a void. That's prehistory. You can't even think of that kind of thing.
It feels like that's a good cutoff point though. Radiohead and Beck for this end of history theory that those bands are still like the alternative mainstays that we have. Like no band sort of emerged to that level of legitimate artistic status at the same time of commercial, maybe commercial appeal.
I'd like get into the Feelies and feel really cool, only to discover that my dad had like the t-shirts.
Where are we going here? Now we can cut this one out if you don't want to go under it. But if you could live the rest of your life in the David Bowie dress of one persona,
oh, I think I'm doing it.
You're doing it.
Yeah,
just what you got on right now.
Yeah, I'm pretty.
You're always garbed in it.
Yeah, I think it wears me, and I wear it.
I'm gonna go with Jareth the Goblin King.
Oh no, as long you're as not. Really,
as long as I can get the ability to transform into a farm.
You know, I was afraid. I was afraid that we weren't gonna get out of this without talking about Muppets. I had a feeling Muppets were.
I mean, Muppets has to come up.
Yeah, right. There's always death in the room. There's always Muppets. Always Muppets in the closet.
Two constants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Death at the house and the tomb and Muppets.
Yeah.
That's it. So let's get back to the Bowie as writer.
Yeah. All right. All right, what haven't we said regarding that?
So you're saying that Sebald is sort of the literary equivalent of Bowie? Do you feel like a literary
on this
equivalent?
Album. Oh, no, only on this album. Because, of course, he's another guy who's you know, speaks almost posthumously and seems to sum up everything about his country and about literature. He's the ultimate traveler, the ultimate traveler who from a picture can extrapolate like an entire history. And there's just I can't remember what book it is. I don't think it's The Emigrants. What is it? There's one where Nabokov is always ahead of him. There's always like a few butterflies left in Nabokov's wake, but we all, you know, every chapter gives us a little Nabokov, and that was my reason for starting to think like that, because I couldn't imagine why Bowie had started a song with name checking Nabokov. That's like something Nick Cave would do. Nothing against Nick Cave, but it's not really usually Bowie's style to get into that particular literary bent. You know, Nietzsche is more his style.
Mm. I couldn't come up with an answer for this question. It was too elaborate for me. Too much going on.
Yeah, you can't think
What about the whole trajectory of the career? That's more of what I was thinking of. Like, is there a writer whose sort of approach to prose and art mirrors Bowie's approach to music and persona?
Other than Bowie? Yeah, let's see. That's a good one.
I couldn't do it.
Is there anybody who every book, every novel has managed to transform himself so completely?
Pinchin, I put a question mark in
it. Yeah, I don't know. Pynchon is so characteristic.
Yeah.
See, that's the thing. Like, Bowie's characteristic is having no characteristic.
Yeah.
He reflects, he reflects us back at him. He even reflects, our ideas about him back at us.
Right.
I think that might be impossible within a literary form, because when you come down to it, compared to music,
an expression of consciousness,
kind of a one-way mirror in some ways. You know, you gotta, like, one guy is doing that, and then years
Thomas
later, you're
Bernhardt isn't
gonna
switch things up.
That's right. So I'm not sure you can really do what the same thing. I hate to say it, but no, I'm sure there's a perfect example. I'm sure there's somebody that's eluding me. Nabokov is all right. Nabokov's not bad.
Nabokov could work, maybe.
Yeah, Nabokov's not bad, because, like I said, he's he seems like he can excel.
But there was still
in any style.
Characteristic.
I guess so.
Stuff.
Characteristic, like, well, like it's good. Yeah, they're always good. To say that there's to say that Bowie is bad, that's, even when he's bad, it's about being bad. It reflects a certain badness. Like,
right.
Tin Machine. That's like
Tin Machine.
Yeah. Tin Machine, that's like a necessary badness. That's like anti-art. That's amazing. That's like a palate cleansing. That comes at the end of the 80s when Bowie, you know about this, right?
No, you're gonna have to elaborate.
Oh, okay. So in the when Bowie gets naturally sick of himself in the 80s, after he's released he's just gone on his most expensive, most like hair gel tour. Really, the 80s culminated with Never Let Me Down, which is just an unlistenable album, just the worst. And it's like Genesis or something, man. And totally of its era, completely soulless and disposable. And so Bowie forms a band called Tin Machine, and only one person has ever liked them in the history of anything, and that's Bowie. Yeah, he's like the only Tin Machine fan in the world. They release two albums, and really nobody likes it. Nobody understands it. But he keeps Reeves Gabrels, the guitarist in that band, goes on to be his regular guitarist for the next like slew of albums.
And he's on this album?
He's not on this one.
Okay.
This album has a good assemblage of ex-Bowie. It has, of course, Tony Visconti is the producer,
right.
His old standby producer, mm-hmm. Probably the most...
Him and Brian Eno?
Mm-hmm.
Him and Brian Eno being like...
Visconti more than Eno,
yeah.
I guess. Eno was like more like... that's like when Rocky like goes into the hills.
Gets the other trainer.
Yeah, that's like when Rocky gets the other trainer.
Yeah.
And, we have the montage and everything. Tony Visconti was
the Nigel Goodrich to Radiohead for David Bowie. Sort of.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But I think we were talking about
He was the Burgess. He was the Burgess Meredith.
Okay,
for sure.
There you go.
We
were talking about fixed identity, and as we say, these lists are extremely arbitrary. But Bowie rarely ranks, I think, in the top, in the upper echelon of these sort of solo artists, the Dylans,
oh, yeah, but that
the Neil
mean
Youngs,
doesn't
mean
yeah.
anything. But do you think there's reasons underlying that?
I think if we look at those reasons, we're going to take a...
We'll die.
We're going to take the nonsense train and solipsism station. However, it is weird that listening to classic rock stations, you occasionally hear Suffragette City or something next to Deep Purple. It comes as such a relief. But no, you know...
looking back, his records of... I mean, even Ziggy Stardust, it peaked at 75 on the Billboard charts.
Yeah.
Which is baffling.
Yeah, that's surprising.
Because that's his breakout album. I mean, breakout in the commercial.
It wasn't in America. It wasn't in America. Nobody cared about that album in America except much later. Well, I mean, like...
That was retroactive?
Yeah, you know, only the... Yeah, you got to remember, like, there's the big difference between... the British music listening public and the American listening public is that everybody in Britain is the music listening public. Like, everybody knows everything.
It's like everyone in Germany reads.
Oh, yeah. It's just like, old grannies know about the... No one remember the Sex Pistols in Britain. Yeah. You know, everybody takes part in... You know, it's a very consensual culture. It's very difficult to be culturally ignorant in Britain.
Yeah.
And the music press there is, of course, just really powerful and, like, over the top and everything. And... you know, things are more spread out here in here in America.
Yeah.
And outside of like major like cultural centers,
yeah.
You wouldn't necessarily hear something like something that's challenging or interesting as Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders of Mars in the early 70s. But Young Americans, of course, broke him here. I think that was the real breakout album because everybody heard Young Americans. You know, we like to hear about ourselves.
Oh, right. Let's see, did we cover everything? We might have covered everything. Oh, well, wait, no, let's talk about Sunshine. Your boy Sunshine.
Oh, yeah, well, that's just a weird thing.
Is it the type of anecdotes people wait, like, listen in for?
Well, when I was, so after I graduated from college, I was like a townie for 1 year, and I...
This was where?
Oh, I went to Bard College upstate, and I was living in this place, Germantown, in this weird house, and my upstairs neighbor was this dude, Ronnie Sunshine, who was like, you remember like Mr. Dink from like Doug?
I do.
Yeah, he was like a profane, like drug-addled Mr. Dink.
Dink.
Yeah, and he'd been this like cocaine dealer in the 70s, and he'd run this limousine service, and he'd have these customers. I kind of just thought he was full of it until he started showing me all these pictures of himself hanging out with, like, Salvador Dali and, like, Johnny Thunders and Truman Capote. And so, yeah, Bowie was his best customer, naturally. And
he had Bowie pictures?
He didn't have Bowie pictures, but at that point I believed him. I'm not sure that Bowie would show up on film in that period.
The Salvador Dali is great.
Yeah, yeah.
This was in Germantown, New York?
Up in Dutchess County.
Okay.
I don't know. There's probably a lot of Germantowns. What were
they? His Coke was that good?
I don't know.
They were driving all the way up.
Yeah, I don't know. I was a teetotaler. I never sampled.
Okay. That's just a great story.
Yeah. You know, we haven't really talked too much, that much about the tracks. Maybe it's time
to
wade in a little bit
do
a little breakdown.
You want to go in order? You want to go scattershot?
Well, what are your favorites? Tell me where you're at.
I mean, I'm really liking Love is Lost.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Love is Lost is probably my... That and You Feel So Lonely You Could Die, I think, are my two standouts on the
album. Really? Yeah, cool. I like Valentine's Day an awful lot. And
the guitar is really big in that one. I like that.
Yeah, yeah, huge. And, of course, I like the dirty sax on Dirty Boys. Good choruses on You Will Set the World on Fire. See, this is just what I was afraid we would do. Bossa. Yeah. You know what? I like them all, actually, I guess, come to think of it.
I'm not a fan of If You Can See Me.
Hmm.
Is that representative of Tin Machine? Is that why?
No, it's not. It's not Tin Machine territory. Yeah, If You Can See Me, I Can See You?
Yes.
Right. Hmm. Where are we on... Where are we now at this point? Like, after all of the...
I understand its role in...
Yeah.
The album itself.
Yeah.
Coming out of the sort of purgatorial state he was in.
Yeah, it's a strange thing.
You sort of have the geriatric moment where, you know, he snaps in and now he's himself again, or like someone snaps the finger in front of his face.
He looked pretty good in that video.
Yeah.
I was happy to see him.
Oh, I mean, for the whole video, I'm like, oh my God, is he actually on bed rest or for those first couple of minutes, which I think is a great sort of ploy by him.
Yeah.
Smart, you know, knowing your audience type deal.
Right.
But I mean, as we said, I think Stars Are Out is a more traditional single, and anyone else would have put that, I think, as the lead one.
It was amazing, like, how natural he looked with, what's her name as his wife?
Tilda Swinton.
Yeah.
Well, she's the sort of androgynous female Bowie.
That was really funny. Yeah, that was pretty funny.
When they have the sort of wall-to-wall...
I forgot that they weren't actually married when I saw the video. I was just like, oh yeah, it's Bowie and his wife.
He's got his wife is black, like a 6-foot-tall black model, right?
Yeah, but in the moment I forgot, it just seemed so so natural.
They're sort of weird mirrors of each other, actually. Like she could definitely play David Bowie in a cross-dressing movie and win the Oscar.
Oh yeah, right. You're talking about Tilda Swinton.
Yes,
not Amon.
Not Amon. If Amon did it, she would definitely win the Oscar, or at least the prosthetic and makeup people would.
It'd be an I'm not there kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
I guess Cate Blanchett could kind of pull off Bowie too.
Oh yeah, she'd be great.
Now is the in the video there's like Bowie and the sort of family domestic scene on one side, and then the rock band and the concert going on the other side of the house.
Oh yeah, that's so
dumb. Is that Tilda Swinton singing, or is that a third party that resembles Bowie?
Oh, you mean who's doing that? No, that's what's that actress's name? The actress that's playing Bowie, young Bowie in that in that one. Yeah, what's her name? She's like a Turkish actress or something. Mm. No, she's fascinating. But I can't think what she's called at the moment.
Any closing remarks?
Oh, no, I'll just say, you know, don't let the sun blast your shadow or the milk flow cloud your mind.
That is perfect. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.